The House Transportation Committee will come to order. Welcome, everybody. We're going to go ahead and start off today with opening a work session on House Bill 2377. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2377, we heard this way back 2 months ago, February 20th. It's the measure that requires the use of a hands-free accessory to lawfully use a mobile communication device while operating a motor vehicle. The bill as written provided certain exceptions, but you have in front of you the Dash 4 amendment. That amendment was worked out, developed by a work group that had the participation of our two sponsors for the measure, as well as several other groups. The amendments, I believe our sponsors may go through them, but just briefly, they specify that this is a primary offense for anybody who's using it, rather than it was a secondary offense in the previous bill for people under 18 who were using one. And it also revises the exceptions. The exceptions now include, under the Dash 4, is persons providing public safety services or emergency services as a volunteer, persons acting in the scope of employment as a public safety officer, persons operating a motor vehicle in scope of employment if the motor vehicle is necessary for their job, persons activating or deactivating the device, as in using a hand to touch the on or off button, that would not count as using your hands, and persons using a function of the device that allows for only one-way voice communication in certain circumstances. Oh, and we also have, for the Dash 4, a minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Patrick. And I have Representative Escobar and Representative Tomei who are here if we need any clarification or any questions we have to ask. So do you have anything you want to add to this?
Well, I think we just want Representative Tomei, House District 41, Chair Beyer Committee, just to make clear that this was the agreement that we reached on. The Dash 4 amendment was an agreement that was worked out with a group of stakeholders.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Seeing none.
I take
more than.
I was just looking at the Dash 4 amendments. Am I looking at the correct amendments?
Yes.
Dash 4. And I was looking at page 2, line 16. Actually 15 and 16, which reads, to a person activating or deactivating the mobile communication device or, quote, a function of the device. And I guess I need to know what the words a function of the device meant in the work group.
Madam Chair, right. Representative Bentz, for the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. Representative, I believe that means several things. One is that you can turn it on or off, and or there's a lot of devices that are run through your radio where you have to do that as well. There's some of these devices are various types of on-off, so I believe that's what we're trying to capture here.
Follow-up. When I read it seemed to me that it was broad enough to include dialing a phone if one wanted to dial their phone, or input other information into a device, and I was just wondering how one could avoid the argument that this allowed much of that which one's trying to avoid with a hands-free device.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, I would like everyone to think about this, and this is what this boils down to. Put your hand right here. Try to look back at traffic. That's what we're trying to avoid. The other thing is that if you do, of course, I have a device that sticks in my ear that I press a button and it asks me who I want to call. They're available. The technology's there. I would prefer to write that in the law, but I think that's a little getting too restrictive. People will, in fact, have a problem when you have a cell phone at your ear. That seems to be the problem. When people are utilizing cell phone facilities, that is the problem. Whereas if you have hands-free, if you are speaking to that thing that's in your ear or wherever, or in your dashboard, or up above. There are several ways you can do that. That creates a time when you are able to concentrate more on what you're doing as a driver than what you aren't doing when you're operating your cell phone. There's been the argument of what about the person that's in the car with you? Well, we've all had people in the car with us. We've had either children in the back seat, or we've had people at the side or whatever. Chances are, at least with me, I don't sit and specifically look at the person while I'm driving. I'm looking at the road, speaking to them. This is a similar situation. If you looked at the person that you were riding with, it would take away from your concentration on the road. What we're trying to do is concentrate those people directly on the road instead of what they're holding in their hand or what they're trying to do other than pay attention to the road. And it's okay to talk on a phone because it's no different than speaking with someone in your car. But it's not okay to have something up here that, one, obstructs your vision when you're trying to change a lane, or, two, distracts you as a driver because you have one hand on the wheel and the other one on this.
Representative Schaffler, and then Representative Berger.
I think that's not what I'm not sure. I don't believe that's what my friend was speaking to. To activate could be interpreted to mean to dial or to text. I mean, I support your concept, but this, I have reservations here. If you said to a person activating or deactivating a hands-free device, then I could see it. But the way this is a mobile communications device, I think under this language, you could literally be texting while you're driving, because you're activating that device by dialing or texting.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I believe, unless we've inadvertently taken it out, texting is prohibited.
Well, anyway, I support the concept, but I do share my friend's concerns about this language.
Representative Berger, and then Boone.
Yeah, I, at the risk of piling on, my original objection to this bill still holds, which is there. While turning your head may be a problem, the real problem is what you're doing when you're dialing or taking the code off your phone before you dial, the security code, and the fussing with the phone. I guess my question is, by this amendment, are you accepting that from the prohibition? Or was this amendment only aimed at those click and release type hands devices, which I forget the name of them because it's been so long ago.
Chair Beyer, Representative Berger, our intent in the work group was to allow people to turn the phone on and off. It was, and we deliberately mentioned texting on the first page of the bill, on line 8, means a text messaging device. So our intent, and maybe that's what we need to just state on the record, was this was meant to turn the phone on and off, that was allowable. It would not be allowable to text message, if that's what Representative Bence was getting at and Representative Schaffler.
Follow-up. Does that mean, would that include dialing?
Well,
my problem, of course, is that the technology of voice only works if you've already inputted that number in.
Right.
And, frankly, that is only usable in a very narrow set of circumstances. And as I have said to you as sponsors of this before, my problem with cell phones is all that fussing and fiddling, dialing and answering that I think is the real danger, along with the talking. And nothing in this gets out of that. In other words, we're still left with half a lump or less, in my opinion. So do you mean to exclude dialing the number or not? Turning it on or off doesn't do you much good if you can't dial.
Well, Thank you for the question, Chair Beyer, or Representative Berger. I think we did not mean to exclude dialing, assuming that one would not be holding a hands a device up to their ear, that whatever it would be quick, and it would then it would free up your hands. In a sense, the perfect is the enemy of the good. We will not be able to absolutely cut out all distractions, but our intent was to make it as minimal as we possibly could, meeting all of the concerns of the people on the committee that met regarding this bill.
Representative,
thank you for that.
Yes, Representative Boone. And then
thank
Thompson.
You. And I'm assuming I just got a we all got a piece of testimony from Bonnie Altus, but questioning whether or not it applies to emergencies. But it looks like the mobile device is defined with as a text messaging device or a wireless. A two-way communication device designed to receive and transmit voice or text. And then it says to does not apply to a person summoning medical or emergency help if someone else in the car or if there's no one else in the vehicle capable of summoning for, and does not apply to a person operating an ambulance or emergency vehicle or to a person operating a vehicle while providing public safety services or emergency services as a volunteer.
Right.
So that seems to be covered, and so I'm just, no, she's shaking her head. I'm assuming you're going to testify then, and we can...
Well, is a work session.
Oh, right, this is a work session. But so I guess I'm not understanding what the disconnect is there, because I know that was
right.
put in.
And we did have folks, as I said, on the work group that worked on this issue, and they seemed to be satisfied. They were
right.
concerned about training in public safety issues for some of these people who use
so does it
those devices.
Follow up then?
Follow up.
Does it includes then a two-way radio or the radio?
Right, if they're training for emergency situations, mm-hmm. but they would not be able to carry on a conversation going down the road any more than a person would be able to carry on a conversation with a handheld telephone.
Follow up. During an emergency.
So during an emergency, absolutely. Everybody is excluded.
Okay. Then I guess since she's not going to, I need to ask. Says it does not include two-way mobile radio transmitters or receivers used by licensees of FCC and amateur radio, and that's a
handheld device,
yeah.
correct?
Handheld.
Right.
So it does not include that then?
They would be included in the language that said they cannot use a handheld device unless they were trained and using it for training purposes.
Follow up. Or an actual emergency.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, you received this too. Can anybody up here? What am I missing here?
We can go ahead and bring her up if you have some questions you want to ask.
If that's possible, thank you.
Sure. Are there any other questions? I forgot. Representative
Jaffa. That's
okay.
Look, I agree. I'll definitely vote to keep this bill alive, but you've taken care of the texting. Thank you. We don't want people driving down the road like this. I think that accomplishes this. But I still... To activate, what is the definition of activate? Is it just to turn off or on, or could it be construed to mean dialing? And if it can be, and believe me, you guys know at least as well, if not better than I do, people will stretch this language as far as they humanly can, and I don't want people dialing either. So let's make sure we get that, somehow clarify that as this bill moves forward, because I don't want people dialing either. I have to use a stylus to dial on my phone, and I've done it while driving, and it's stupid. But if I can get around the law like everybody else and their dog, by God, I'll probably do it too. So let's make it so I can't.
Madam Chair, Representative Shopper, we will go over LC with that. But to me, when you activate or deactivate, that to me is you're turning it on or off.
Well,
now, to me, when you're dialing, that's the same form as texting. That's my opinion. But then again, if we had 10 attorneys in the room, we'd have 15 different opinions.
Representative Vince.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to make sure by asking you, Representatives, the on page 2 again of the dash 4 amendments, it excludes those who are operating the motor vehicle in the scope of the person's employment if the operation of the motor vehicle is necessary for a person's job. That would exclude, then, those who are merely commuting. Is that true? Your
concept
here is to exclude commuters.
Chair Beyer, Representative Bence, absolutely.
Thank you.
Including you and me.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cole.
And Representative Bence, I think the operative part of I sub A is that subsection, or that section, refers to one-way voice communication. So what we're talking about there is CB operators. And so...
Nextel,
or anything else that you have to push a button, and so does that. I think that must cover a bunch of the concerns addressed in that Representative Boone was addressing. If you're using a one-way communicative device in the scope of your business, operation of your work, then this you're excluded from
absolutely,
this.
Representative.
Yeah, so.
Madam Chair, Representative Call, maybe we should prohibit those from being in hearing rooms as well.
You should talk to Representative Greenlick about that. You might get some
Representative
support.
Bence.
That's fine, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just before we leave, we will go down and get an interpretation on this, but I believe, you know, that's the way I understand the bill. We'll get an interpretation from LC and send it back to you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bonnie Altus, come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Shall I explain how I understand this bill? Madam Chair, and...
For the record, your name.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, my name's Bonnie Altus. I'm an FCC-licensed amateur radio operator, AB7ZQ, and I have met with a number of the committee members earlier in this process. I got a copy of the proposed amendments, and the way I read them, the situations where we would operate as an amateur radio operator and supporting the agencies is very limited. I read it that we would only be able to use the radio mobile while we were participating in the public service event or emergency services event as a amateur radio operator. I don't see anything in here that allows us to operate for our exercises while we're training or prior to the event while we're doing preparation work and setting up a route and checking communication capabilities throughout the route of an event. And also, another big concern that I have about it is that most of the time when we're operating these events, we really don't have anything that proves that that's what we're doing. And so I and a lot of other amateur radio operators are concerned that we could be stopped by a law enforcement officer because they don't know that we're participating in the event. And depending on who it is, we might have a challenge showing that. So we'd have to work harder at making sure we always had documentation with us from the agency that we were supporting so that we would have that proof with us. And those are my main concerns with it. Questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Bonnie. That was one of my questions, too, is I read it that it can, but I understand now that you say that for planning or whatever, but in terms of operating a motor vehicle in the scope of a person's employment, is it because of the volunteer nature?
Yeah, we're not employees. We're volunteers. It's illegal based on the FCC rules to operate amateur radio for employment and to be paid for doing it. We can only do it as a volunteer legally.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
And I think maybe we should have Representative Tomei answer this. It is my understanding that it's in the intent of allowing operation during emergency services type work.
That's exactly
whether
right.
Whether it's, like as she said, an actual emergency event, but preparing for one, she gives in the testimony, she gives an example of being, and I know exactly what she's talking about, in the 2007 floods, they fire department personnel were sent out to find out if a road was blocked. Sometimes, and there's no power, so there's no lights. If a road is blocked, couldn't you get emergency equipment through or not? And what constitutes, you know, and when they're training for such a thing, is that valid then? Would that be acceptable?
Chair Beyer, Representative Boone, that's exactly right. And that was exactly our intent. And that's what we heard from the folks that you're referring to, ma'am. And that's when we asked for LC to draft this amendment. That's exactly what we said. And we thought that emergency service activities, that would cover it. That was exactly our intent, that it's not just while they're providing the emergency service, but while they're practicing to provide the emergency service when it will be needed.
Thank you.
Committee, Patrick went to see about getting LC down. Do we need them down to address this, or?
Madam Chair, I think that subsection I-C addresses the concerns that are here.
Can you give us the line?
Yeah, I'm sorry, line 24, page 2, line 24. About the use of one-way voice communications for people participating in public safety or emergency service activities. I don't see why anybody would construct those terms to be so narrow as for its applicability to situations where an emergency or an event has already arisen. And, you know, public safety means prevention and preparedness as well as, you know, the actual enactment of activities, you know, to respond to an emergency. So I don't think there's any concern there for me. I think it's pretty clear to me.
Representative Schaffler.
Madam Chair, I'm ready to move the bill. I think we can, in my opinion, get this definition of what activating means squared away. And some reassurance that activating does not mean dialing while you're driving. I think we can do that.
And
are you ready for a motion, Madam
I'm
Chair?
Ready. We're in a work session, so.
Yeah, Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move the -4 amendments to House Bill 2377, dated 3/12/2009.
Thank you. Representative Call has moved the -4 amendments to LC, to House Bill 2377, dated 3/12/2009. Any discussion? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we ask staff what you found out?
We're trying to get Heidi Altmaier out of council to come down, or at least Representative Esquivel beat me down there. He's trying to ask her the very question that we were developing earlier.
Well, I think, I'm ready to go with it if that's included, which I've been assured now that it is the intent. And I don't know the procedure past this if it's, I'm not an attorney, so if what is in this amendment will work, I'm ready to go with that.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm prepared to offer a courtesy vote without any commitment for the floor.
Thank you. Any other representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to echo Representative Edwards' remarks. Courtesy vote.
Okay.
We are at this point only on the amendment.
Only the amendment.
On the amendment, right.
Yes.
Same
all right. With that, I suppose we need to call the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Bent?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Courtesy aye.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Wagner? Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Call?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. The amendments have been adopted. Representative Call.
Yeah, yes, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2377 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Call has moved House Bill 2377 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Berger Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With great respect to the proposers of this bill, when we heard it before, I have expressed at that time and continue to have grave concerns that this doesn't answer the problem. People distracted while driving with a cell phone in their ear are a huge problem. What this bill does, however, is only particularly helps when they're driving around with the device actually on, holding it on their ear. They will still have a device in their ear. They will still be talking on the telephone. And there's still the issue of the fussing with the device that has bothered me from the beginning. If cell phone use and distraction is a problem, we need to go whole hog here and not just say to people, well, you need to go to your cell phone company and shell out $50 to $100 for a bunch of equipment that is a half a lump. I will tell you, in some respect, this all comes down to personal stories. And a year ago, my New Year's resolution was to never drive without my hands free, and I invested in quite a bit of equipment. I have never found it satisfactory, never found it work right, always fussing it when my phone would ring. I finally decided I was more of a hazard with the hands-free material than I ever was using my cell phone. There are distracted driver laws. I would be very in favor of strengthening those. But to say that all people talking all the time are a hazard when they have the phone in their hand is to deny the fact that the main hazards with a phone are the distractibility. Who you're talking to, the tenor of that phone conversation has a huge amount to do with your distractibility, and how much fussing you have to do with the hands-free devices also has a huge amount to do with your distractibility. So I'm not happy with a half a lump. Either we're going to say you're not going to drive with a cell phone at all, or we're going to have to find other ways to get at distracted drivers than this. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For many of the reasons articulated by the good representative from West Salem, I have ongoing concerns about the bill. However, in deference to the representatives who brought this bill forward in a spirit of bipartisanship and out of respect for my colleagues who want to vote for this bill on the floor, I will offer a courtesy vote in committee.
Thank you. Representative, anybody else over here? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Bent?
No.
Representative Berger?
No.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye, as a courteous vote.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative
Leitner?
Representative
Tillman?
Representative Call?
Aye.
Chair Meyer? Aye. And for the record, Representative Widener is excused.
So it's true? He has a crab attached to his ear, won't let go.
No comment.
I had to do it.
Yes, House Bill 2377 received the requisite number of votes. It's passed. And who is the carrier?
Carol.
Representative.
I'm Representative and I.
You want joint?
Joint.
All right, who do you want to be the lead? You worry it out.
You're here.
Okay.
You get it.
I'm going to close the work session on 2377. Open a public hearing on 2892. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2892 requires railroad companies to display railroad signs and signals and to place targets on switches. I think I'm right. It directs the Department of Transportation to adopt rules prescribing specifications for the design and location of railroad targets and signals.
Thank you. Okay. Scott Palmer and Tony Hessler and Lynn Larabach, if you all want to come up. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, my name is Lynn Lerbach, and I'm a representative for the Joint Council of Teamsters in the state of Oregon, representing over 30,000 members. I'm sitting here today with my brother locomotive engineers, who are members of our Teamster Union also. And I come before you in full support of 2892, and I will leave the professional testimony to my good brothers, the engineers.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me to speak today on behalf of House Bill 2892, Signs and Signal Bills. My name is Scott Palmer, and I work as a locomotive engineer for the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. And in addition to working full-time in that capacity, I'm also the Oregon State Legislative Board Chairman for the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. And for 15 of my last 20 years, I've been involved in safety on the railroad, whether it's site safety team, local site safety team. I've been involved in FRA safety programs such as SAC-P, Safety Assurance and Compliance Program, RSAC, which is a Railroad Safety Advisory Committee, most recently on the SOFA Committee, which is Switching Operations Fatality Analysis. So I've had a huge background in safety. House Bill 2892 is a very simple bill. It is meant to save the lives of both railroad employees and the public. And here's what the problem is. What a sign looks like, its shape, its color, where it's placed, isn't regulated by the Federal Railroad Administration. And as a result, the railroads in the state have different signs to tell trains to stop, different signs to tell trains to slow down, to warn them of switches that are improperly lined and derails. There are different versions of a stop sign on the same property. And the trouble is that we all run on each other's tracks all the time. And whether by joint trackage rights, detours, or simply through an interchange of cars, train crews are using other railroads' tracks on a daily basis. Some crews, particularly in the Portland area, can cross several properties in a single trip. Multiple versions of the same signs cause confusion. If a crew member misidentifies a sign through inexperience, fatigue, or even by a simple mistake, the risk of a serious incident rises dramatically. Now, in the first handout, current railroad signs in use in Oregon, you can clearly see how many signs there are in use. I only included the top three carriers in the state, Burlington Northern, Portland Western, UP, but ODOT lists 23 different carriers in the state. And if you look at this thing, I mean, just the stop signs alone, we've got five different versions of stop signs in the state. One of them white. A white stop sign. No one has ever seen or heard of a white stop sign before, but we've got one. We only need one stop sign. For instance, track flags. Flags that warn us to slow down for bad track or that men are in the middle of the track ahead of us. Six different versions. We need one yellow-red, one green. We don't need to find six different versions out there on the different tracks we cross. Derail signs, you name it, you got it. I have seen derail signs out there that aren't even listed in the books. They're so old, and yet they're still existent on property. There's 10 different versions of signs that govern train speed, tell trains to slow down. We have as much as a 40-mile-an-hour difference in some cases where trains have to slow down. And we've got signs that I've never even seen before and certainly wouldn't recognize if I ever ran across them on property. We only need three. One that warns us when we need to slow down ahead, one that tells us when that speed takes effect, and one to release us from that speed when we're through that area. Whistle posts. We have whistle posts provided to warn us so we can sound our horn 15 to 20 seconds prior to entering the crossing. That's an FRA rule. Every railroad out there has whistle posts. There's no requirement for them to have them, no requirement for them to put them back up when they get knocked down, and there's no requirement for the accuracy of placement. They're supposed to be a quarter mile from the road crossing, but what happens is when they aren't, we can't whistle properly. We can't provide that 15 to 20 seconds warning. At speeds of 45 miles an hour and below, we have to count in our heads a delay before we whistle so we hit that 15 to 20 second mark. for instance, at 25 miles an hour, I have to count in my head to 16 before I begin to whistle. If that whistle post is incorrectly placed, and I've seen them off by 800 feet in a quarter mile, then my whistle is going to be off. And it does not provide the correct amount of warning for the public. The portion of the bill that deals with yellow flags and yellow-red flags comes straight out of the carrier's own general code of operating rules. It does not represent any kind of real substantive change. Yellow flags warn trains of temporary speed restrictions 2 miles ahead, and that's because the track is bad. There's no corresponding federal regulation, once again, on the accuracy or design of the yellow flags. I've recently seen one off by a mile on a 2 mile standard. Now, if you go into that area of rough track or disturbed track without slowing down, the chances of derailing are huge. And given everything we're carrying in our train, and I've handled everything from chlorine to ketchup in the same train, you're rolling the dice. Each and every time, these standards are different, unrecognized, or off. Now, the same can be said for the yellow-red flags. Those protect men and equipment. They are between the rails, pounding spikes, doing whatever, cutting rail, welding rail. The only additional requirement I have that isn't already an industry standard is for the flags to be placed and written warning to be issued to the crews within 24 hours of the railroad determining that they do have a Form B restriction in that area. I got an email from a guy on the Portland Western, said after a week later, after they'd identified this track restriction, they still didn't have any flags up. So these guys had to guess where the restriction started. They didn't have anything to measure it by. And what happens if they guess wrong? In their case, I think they were going 55 and they had to slow down to 25. They've got absolutely no idea where 72.05 might be in between the mileposts. The advanced speed boards warn a train that has to slow down for a permanent restriction, and Burlington Northern Santa Fe uses a 2 mile placement for that. So they'll place their advanced speed board 2 miles from where the slower speed takes effect. Union Pacific has two different standards. On some portions of UP, they place it 2,500 feet away. On some portions, they place it 2 miles away. So there's a different standard right there, even on their own property. So the big problem is we get engineers out there who see these signs, don't know if they're 2,500, don't know if they're placed 2 miles in advance. It causes confusion. We have had people go in hot, not slow down in time. The big problem is if you're moving at 60 miles an hour, that's 88 feet a second. You've got 12,000 tons of train behind you. If you're moving at 55 with a 100-mile-an-hour car and dump your train, place it into emergency, you can't stop for a mile. There's no way you can slow down and drop 40 miles an hour on a freight train if your only warning is that 2,500-foot speed sign. We need 2 miles. It only makes sense. Oregon still has non-signal territory, virtually unchanged since your grandfather was a kid. He'd recognize it instantly. The maximum speed there is 49 miles an hour. The switches that a train uses to leave or enter the main line are manual. So the train has to stop at the switch. Crew member has to get out and line the switch for the correct route. When that switch is lined to leave the main, a red target is visible on the switch stand. I've got some pictures of that in there. We've got a beautiful red target that tells us that switch is lined against us. It's lined for us to leave the main line, 49 mile an hour main line onto a 10 mile an hour siding. Now the problem is when it's lined for main line movement, that red target turns edge on, we can't see a thing. So we see red, that means stop. We see nothing, that means go. Well, here's the problem with seeing nothing. We've had people steal those targets before, so even though the switch was lined against a train, the crew saw nothing. They assumed they were lined correctly. We have also had someone deliberately try to force a switch open in advance of a train carrying chlorine gas. The bill requires both red and green reflectorized targets on mainline switches in non-signal territory where the maximum speed exceeds 20 miles an hour. We want to be able to see where the switch is and what position it's in. We have had trains overrun their authority because they could not see where the switch was, even with the headlights on. And don't let anybody tell you this bill is going to cause confusion between the train crews, because we are confused right now. Portland's different than Eugene. Eugene's different than Klamath. Klamath is different than Hermiston. In these timetables, they list all of the signs that are in effect on the property. And both the UP and the Portland and Western don't list that white stop sign. So these crews, even though we have a white stop sign, aren't going to recognize it because it's not even on here. Things are different state to state, terminal to terminal, depot to depot. We have a case, the UP yard, where the switches on one end of the yard are completely opposite from what they mean on the other end of the yard. So even in a single depot, 5,000 feet away, you've got different standards. Pardon me. California has different high wide and crossing and warning restrictions than we do. We are used to having different standards. We have laws covering topics like hazmat inspections, radio requirements, crew size, and many more that are unique to Oregon and nowhere else, and that are complied with by crews based in Washington, Idaho, and California, and Oregon. We've all got that. The whistle regulations in the Union Pacific have right in them that everybody is issued a different set of whistle conditions for California and Montana because they have state laws that are different. You know, what could be confusing about eliminating choices? If I gave you a multiple choice test with 10 choices, maybe you get it right, maybe you wouldn't. If I gave you that same test and there was only one choice, there's absolutely no way you're going to fail. That's what this bill is about. We don't need multiple choices. The big question, of course, is preemption. And surely the FRA must have some kind of regulations about signs. They don't. Exhibit 1 is a letter from the FRA to Vice President John Tolman of the VLET. In this, he states unequivocally that the FRA does not regulate whistle posts. Number 2, this is an NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, report of a train wreck that resulted in a fatality. And in this case, the engineer looked down the lead, saw all of the targets were all the same color, and assumed that meant he was going to go on a straight track. Well, in this particular yard, one of the switches that was green meant something completely different. And he went out on the main line in front of a loaded coal train, and the collision killed the conductor on the loaded coal train. As a result of that report, one of the things that you'll find in there is the NTSB says that the FRA does not regulate targets. So there's no preemption on this issue. As a matter of fact, the only place in 49 CFR is in Part 218, where FRA says, visually determine that the switch points fit properly and switch targets, if so equipped, correspond with the switch's position. So that's not regulated. Handout 3 is a copy of current California state line signed by Governor Schwarzenegger last year. And this deals with mileposts, accurate mileposts, accurate whistle posts, advanced speed signs, and flagging requirements. That's already been signed. That has already passed the preemption challenge. And for anyone who's still in doubt about preemption, I have the white stop sign brought to us by ODOT, who designed and required this sign for use. So we can regulate those areas. You're going to hear a little bit about positive train control today. PTC is one of the requirements that came out of the Rail Safety Improvement Act, and that was spurred by Metrolink 111's crash at Chatsworth, California last September that left 25 dead. I was at that crash investigation with the NTSB, and I was at the positive train control RSAC held by the FRA earlier this year, so I can speak to PTC. PTC uses GPS to determine where the train is. It's got a downloaded set of maps on the engine, and it uses a penalty brake application to stop the train short of colliding with another train, running beyond their authority, improperly lined switch, workman limits. I love PTC. It is a wonderful technology. But here's where it fails as far as House Bill 2892 is concerned. Now, one of the things they probably didn't mention is not everyone requires PTC. There's three triggers. You've got to be 5 million gross tons a year or over, and or have passenger commuter rail, and or handle poison inhalation hazard gas, chlorine. If you don't meet those triggers, any one of those, you don't need PTC. Out of the 23 railroads in Oregon, two, maybe three, would probably require positive train control. No one else would. The railroads can reroute shipments to keep a line from triggering PTC requirements. So if they can ship their chlorine, their one shipment a year around on a different route, and avoid triggering that positive train control requirement, they can certainly do that. If business drops and the triggers are no longer met, they can cancel PTC. They can pull the plug on it until such time as they hit one of those triggers again. PTC quits working at a minimum speed, usually 10 to 20 miles an hour, so you can still run through a switch, over a derail, or out in the main line in front of a train. PTC doesn't show where the rear of the train is, so the crew with inaccurate mileposts still don't know what they're clear of. It doesn't see road crossings, and so it can't help an engineer whistle correctly for a road crossing if the whistle posts are off. If it fails en route, you can still continue to your next destination. So now you have no protection whatsoever. It won't alert a crew when they enter a new type of operation. It doesn't let you know where speed restrictions end. If PTC is inaccurate, or if the mileposts are inaccurate, PTC is going to be inaccurate. It's a great tool, and I love PTC. It's going to save a lot of lives, but it is not a panacea. It doesn't answer all of the questions that House Bill 2892 is meant to eliminate. Now, HB 2892 provides a unique opportunity to prevent accidents, derailments, injuries, and it's cheap. The current cost of that big red sign you saw on that handout is $23.14. That's what the railroad pays for that sign. Most of 2892 can be complied with simply by going out and measuring and moving the signs that are already out there. Everybody already has their own workforce. They've got their track inspectors. That's just something that happens day-to-day routine basis. This is something that should have been done 140 years ago. I mean, in the 1860s, when they drove that golden spike at Promontory, Utah, they should have said, well, now that we're joined continent to continent, we better have the same signs. It hasn't. Everything has grown up differently and independently. As recently as April 2nd of this year, the National Transportation Safety Board in R0901, R0902, called for all signal aspects nationwide to become uniform. They've already had a wreck where a guy was going over property where this sign meant that and that sign meant something else. Looking at just the price, if Burlington Northern Santa Fe had to put targets on all of their dark territory in Oregon, they would need to buy 22 targets at a cost total of $509.08. That's what it would cost, and they come with their own hardware. They wouldn't even need to buy the bolts. If they had to change their standard for an advanced speed sign, they'd have to order another 20 for another $462. We're talking $971 to comply with state law one time forever. Union Pacific has no dark territory, $0 for the targets. If ODOT changed the standard of an advanced speed sign and they had to buy 157 of them, statewide, UP would have to pay $3,632.98. This is a good bill. It does a lot for very, very little. It's non-punitive, and I know it's going to save lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Byer, members of this committee, I would like to thank the Transportation Committee for this opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 2892. My name is Tony Hessler. I work as a locomotive engineer for the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. I'm also a local chairman for the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, Division 842 in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Along with being involved in safety in our terminal as a site safety team member, I do address safety concerns that affect day-to-day operation as well as discipline assessed to my membership by the carrier. House Bill 2892 will address deficiencies within the railroad industry and provide a safer work environment for both employees and the public. The bill would require a standardization of railroad signs that better enable train crews to comply with speed changes, public grade crossing warning, and position of switches in dark territory, to name a few. Those of us who work within the industry cannot stress the importance enough of putting in place any component that will ensure both our own and the public's safety concerning the nation's railroads. Our industry ranks second to the trucking industry in the amount of interaction with the public we encounter daily in the transportation of interstate commerce throughout the United States, and safety must be a priority. I've been working within the industry for 34 years. The Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad is the second largest carrier of commerce, of interstate commerce, and we operate daily under joint trackage rights by the tracks owned by the largest carrier of interstate commerce, the Union Pacific Railroad. Yellow track flags are placed 2 miles in advance of a temporary speed restriction to warn trains of bad track. The speed restriction can require trains to slow from 70 miles an hour to or above to as little as 10 miles an hour. And a yellow red warns trains to stop 2 miles ahead due to men or equipment fouling the track. On BNSF Railroad, the dispatcher will issue a verbal speed restriction over the radio that the conductor will write down on an accompanying form, provided within the general track bulletins. The Union Pacific dispatcher will give the same type of verbal restriction with no comparable form, often miles in advance of the restriction, without track flags being displayed. In both of these cases, accurate mileposts are essential to comply with the restrictions as well as protect men and equipment working in the area. We have had these restrictions given verbally by radio, oftentimes in excess of 24 hours after they were identified, and with no track flags, you are left to guess at the exact location the bad track begins. You add inclement weather to this situation, and you got a recipe for disaster. I have addressed numerous concerns with our employer regarding the methods used to denote these areas of disturbed track, and the common sense approach is just to place track flags. The standardization of advanced speed boards will allow crew adequate notice regardless of how often they operate over a segment of track. Extra crews called to operate trains, operate over different segments of the railroad, are often unfamiliar with the grade or characteristics of the particular run, not having operated over it often, or in another capacity such as a conductor or a brakeman. In the current qualification standard used by the carrier in non-mountain grade territory, less than 1.8%, the engineer is only required to have operated over the line segment once in the last year. The standard for mountain grade territory in excess of 1.8% is one trip in the last 6 months, or 180 days. Often both crew members in the cab have not operated over the territory in months. The engineer, having been promoted from the rank of conductor or to engineer for this trip because of manpower needs, and factor in the differences of advanced warning signs, and we increase the probability of an incident. These restrictions are often for curved track, and exceeding the posted speed limit on a curb will cause the track to roll over and derail the train. If hazardous material is derailed, we could have a release of toxic substances. Just as a side note, Chair Beyer, last night at approximately 8 o'clock, I received my first of three calls from demoted engineers that were not in the quota in the terminal at Klamath Falls. The carrier, because of manpower needs, had to promote this one young engineer that hadn't been at the throttle for 3 years. He was qualified 3 years ago, and they needed to send him out on the road. So put these other obstacles in front of him, and again, we've got a recipe for disaster. This industry, like all others, has seen advancements made in technology to provide a safer work environment for both the public and its employees. We are given tools that were designed to satisfy the industry standard for advanced warning at public grade crossings that sadly do not work as intended. The crew is required to sound the engine horn prior to entering road crossings not less than 15 seconds nor more than 20 seconds. A horn sequencer designed to eliminate the need for an engineer to count down a delay in his head at speeds less than 45 miles an hour would be activated by the engineer at the whistle. For instance, at 25 miles per hour, an engineer must delay 16 seconds before beginning to whistle in order to give the required 15 to 20 seconds of warning. The horn sequencer automatically counts down the delay and begins to whistle at the correct distance. Our whistle boards are so inaccurate that we cannot use this technology, although it would always ensure the public of adequate warning with minimal use of resources to properly place these whistle boards the correct distance from the crossing. I have been involved in grade crossing accidents, and they always end tragically for the survivors, families, and crew members, for we are victims as well. Loss of life, grievous injury, years of litigation, and loss of livelihood will be lessened by simply placing these signs where they belong. The carriers are reluctant to put in place the simplest of fixes in dark territory that inform crews of the position of switches. A reflective green target would tell the crew they were lined for the main track versus a reflective red target that would tell them they were lined into a siding just makes sense. I have had two crews that have had switches and derails tampered with that have gone into sidings above the speed for the siding, and in one instance they derailed. The minimal investment to further safeguard the safe transportation of hazardous materials and our own safety far outweigh the inconvenience to our employer. I have addressed just a few of the issues in HB 2892 will correct and provide for a safer work environment for the public as well as those employed in the industry. I urge you all to support 2892. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. You guys make a very compelling case, I got to tell you. I'm really not, and these questions aren't necessarily aimed at you guys because we're going to hear from some other people here, but if you want to answer them, go ahead. I'm really not sure yet exactly what the federal government regulates and doesn't regulate. I agree with you. Why we haven't, we got uniform signs for our trucks and cars and motorcycles. For the life of me, I can't understand after 140 years why they haven't done this. And I'm not really sure what the role is as far as rulemaking goes on signs. And clearly, we can if they designed that stop sign. I believe we can do that. But I'm not really sure. I hear different comments about preemption, or we may be sued if we do something. I don't know if the railroad or the federal government would come down on us on that. But we last week had a hearing in here relating to the closure of crossings, a road crossing the railroad tracks. And I said then, and I still agree, I don't want to tell the railroad how to run the railroad because they know how to run a railroad. But here we have the guys that are actually literally physically running the train railroad, and you're calling for this, and I don't understand why the railroads themselves, the business, doesn't want some uniformity. I don't understand that, and they can come up and speak for themselves, but especially the most compelling argument I have is that switch, where if you make it so that it's visible no matter what, that's a compelling. Why wouldn't we want to do that? I mean, on the job site in construction, we all got safety first stickers on our hats, and there's a huge priority. And they actually look for ideas from workers to try and make it safer, better, because that's going to make it more productive, more efficient, and more profitable, I might add. So actually, I think there's a profit motive in doing something like this. They're going to speak for themselves, but you make a very compelling argument. I know I sure as hell don't want to be out there when a 12,000-ton chunk of God knows what's flying down the road and hitting me because some switch was vandalized, stolen, or... Mm-hmm. Or just wasn't visible for whatever reason. So I make a compelling argument. If you want to try and answer any of those questions or comments, speak to any comments, you're welcome to. But mostly it's aimed at our friends from the railroad and our friends from the department.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. I guess I will say I have talked with all of you gentlemen at least once, and I've had a basic primer from ODOT on this. And To be perfectly honest, it really makes me a little nervous to be sitting up here and making, you know, decisions on how to sign and how to run a railroad. And, you know, take you back to the old slogan, "This is no way to run a railroad," kind of thing. But I want to acknowledge that our standard signing on roads is not done because we did it. I can tell you that, because I can't imagine what a nightmare that might be if the legislature came in and decided we were going to sign all the roads. So, and I just want to say that the more I heard, the more I listened, the more I realized I was in over my head a little bit on this one. So I wanted to get that on the record right now. And we'll go ahead and bring in the other people to talk and see where it goes from there. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Martin and Tom Barrows.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Barrows, representing BNSF Railway. I want to start off by saying that safety is the concern for the railroad as well. We operate in a number of states, and the concern we have is that if you've got unique signage in one state that's contrary to what you have in the other states, that creates safety problems that need to be addressed under this, I believe. Discussion about signs on the roads, that is done, I assume, at the federal level, primarily for interstates at least, and so there's uniformity throughout the states. This bill would not allow for that, and that's where we've got our main concern. Also want to point out that one of the concerns that was raised was of a sign that sometimes is stolen. I don't think that the legislation necessarily deals with that. Stealing a sign is already a crime. I think the railroad tries to get those back up and operational as quickly as possible. I don't know that this would impact that at all.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I'm the lobbyist for the Union Pacific Railroad. Any discussion like this, highly technical, and I think the chair has described it, leaves you in kind of a quandary what to do. The railroads, and I've distributed a piece of material, one pager, from Brock Nelson, who's our supervisor here in the state of Oregon. If you try to pass it here, I think you're making a mistake. First of all, the federal government is where the uniformity should come from. That's the basis of all of this. A conversation like this would lead you to believe that railroads are not safety conscious. I have never represented a company in my 30 years as a lobbyist that is more safety conscious than the Union Pacific Railroad. Every meeting is started by saying, the exits are here, the emergency exit is outside, there's a cardiovascular person on duty, they go through the whole thing before anything else is done at every meeting you attend. And every communication we get from Brock Nelson starts off by, I expect safety. The railroads are, we operate in all the 23 western states, and as Tom Barrows just pointed out, uniformity is something we want. It's been commented, the accident in California was brought up. You had a bill in here earlier today that was the cause of that accident, a cell phone. The public train operator was texting at the time he went through several warning signs that were red, obviously red. Our crew jumped to try to avoid because they saw the thing coming. It was not a violation of any signage. It was a total ignoring by the unfortunate crew of the public train because they both got killed in that accident. The state of California passed legislation like this, and it was overturned by the courts. We can get into a big argument about this. Perhaps if you really want to pursue this whole thing, an interim study would be something you'd want to do. But I certainly hope you don't jump, as meaningful and as good as that testimony was from the union officials. And I respect them. They're the operators, and not on our road, but on Tom's. But you're getting into an area that I think is highly technical and should be left to the federal government if they're going to change signage uniformly throughout the nation. Thank you.
Excuse me. Representative Call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a few questions here. So I guess my first one is, it seems to me like there are two arguments here. One is we should leave it up to the feds, and then the other one is there isn't the signs that we have are adequate. So is it really that we should leave it up to the feds, or is it that the signs are adequate? Because if the signs are inadequate, we should leave it up to the feds. That seems like a good question. So my first question is, are the signs as they stand now in the state of Oregon adequate and safe, or would creating uniformity make them safer?
Madam Chair, Representative Call, my take on that is that this is the first I've heard, when this bill came out, it was the first I've heard of there being problems. We've kind of talked through the chain of command with my folks. I don't think that they see it as a problem. It sounds like the problem may be that different railroads have different standards, and that's where the confusion comes into play. However, if folks are on a train going from state to state on the same line, and you have different signage, then you're going to have problems there. I don't know that it's a problem. I checked with ODOT to see if this is an issue that has been brought to them prior to this, and they said no. The first they heard was with this bill. This isn't something that's been discussed, to my knowledge, among the folks that would be impacted.
So for, and it's BNSF that you represent, is that right?
Correct.
So for BNSF, it's not a matter of the federal government should do this. It's a matter of the system as it exists now is adequate and should not be changed.
Madam Chair, Representative Call, I can't answer that directly for you because that would have to come from the folks that I represent. However, my understanding is that their concern is that if you make it non-uniform from state to state on their line, then you've got new problems to deal with. If there are problems, the railroad is happy to look at trying to fix them if there are inadequate issues under the current system, but I don't know that these have been brought to them or if they've just come straight to you.
And can I ask the same question of you, Roger, please?
Madam Chair and Representative Call, I'm not going to answer the question either without the experts in here. You just heard from two people who spend their entire life running locomotives. We're two government affairs officials trying to represent our company. If you really want to explore this, I'll go get the guy that really knows something about signage and bring it in. If we're concerned about safety, and it was mentioned here, the crossings in Oregon are the most dangerous possible thing about rail. And those crossings are all over the state of Oregon, and both railroads have worked for a long time trying to get as many of those closed, and you hear the complaints about closing crossings. If we start talking about closing a crossing, some city comes in and says, wait a minute, we don't want you to do that. But that's the safety issue in Oregon far more, I think, than the bad signs. But if you want that answer, I'm going to get it for you. But I'm going to get it from somebody that knows how to answer that correctly, not a government affairs person.
Thanks.
Another question?
Okay.
Representative Schaffler.
I think you guys and your companies, which I love and want to get thrive and get rich and continue to provide us with the service that you are, the excellent service, you all should be in the federal government saying, let's make a uniform sign code. That's what I really think you should do. It just makes sense. And then my question is, and you know, yeah, this is the first I heard of it, too, when I met over at the Union Hall back in November. I didn't know. There's a lot of things that I just found out about just this session by being on this committee, but I don't think that's a reason not to try and do something about it. If it's just nothing more than encourage you all to go to the federal government to get a uniform sign code, and it's just simple. Why not make a sign rather than having the on edge thing? Why not? Why would you want a sign that here's one color means go through, and then when it switches 90 degrees, here's another. Mean you have a switch that's been thrown. I don't see why that's a. And you know, you guys, I've known you now for 7 years, and you're professionals, and I enjoy working with you. But business in general, they can be their own worst enemy by resisting change. Be quite frank with you, unions can be their own worst enemy by resisting change. Positive, productive, effective change that makes a difference. And time again, I see common sense ideas and suggestions from the very people on the ground doing the work, not just here, you guys. I'm not beating up on the railroads. Please don't take it that way. And there's just a resistance to that change. So I there they are, right there. Go talk to them after this meeting and see where they work for your road, the people you represent, Mr. Barrows.
That's my understanding.
There they are, right there. Go talk to them, and let's get something going. Do I want to pass a bill where the state's going to be sued and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars fighting in court? The answer to that is no. But I don't think that existing threat hanging over us is an excuse to do nothing, whether it's us, the legislature, the union, or the good people that employ them. So I really think you should be pursuing this, or someday, you know, now it has come to our attention, now we have had a hearing, now you wait. There's one little hangnail on some person, some kid or some person, because of one of these switch things, they're all going to go, why didn't you do something about it before? Not just us, you guys, everybody. So, and I hate to jinx us like that, but that's, you wait and see. One little hangnail.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. And
thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Kelly Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Rail Division. With me today is John Johnson, my Rail Safety Manager. And I brought John with me just in case it got technical and I couldn't answer things. So, although he's hoping it doesn't. So, with that, I've just put a couple of comments down in my testimony. I won't belabor some of the stuff that's already been said. I think the thing to remember is there really are 22 railroads in the state, and 20 of them are short lines, and they operate half the miles in the state. And so they don't necessarily have other people running locomotives on their tracks. They really are pretty much mom-and-pop kind of operations. And they are low business density, low revenue volume. So when you go to standardize something, it does make an impact financially to the small companies. I just want to point that out. Maybe not the class ones, but it is different for the short lines. And, I would say from our standpoint, the thing to do is a federal regulation because it is standardized. And John and I were talking in the back, and I said, I think this is something we need to talk to FRA about, the folks that we deal with in Region 8 up in Vancouver, and see why the FRA hasn't regulated it. It may be that, yes, there's an occasional issue, but it hasn't risen to the issue that they think it's necessary to regulate it across. But I do think that something like this, if you're going to talk about the interstate commerce and the interstate carriers, then it makes sense, like commercial driving licensing and things like that, to have it regulated similarly across the state. There's just a difference between, I just wanted to point out a couple of the things that are in my testimony. There's a difference between the short lines and the class ones. The class ones, Burlington Northern, BNSF, and UP do operate at much higher speeds than typically the short lines do. So placement of signs to be indicative of what you're supposed to do doesn't always match up. Having a whistle post sign a quarter mile out will match 60 miles an hour or above. It doesn't match something less than that. And so they really are regulated by distance, by speed under the FRA. So I just want to point that out. And the same thing with the yellow flags. I mean, the warning flags. Typically on the class ones, it is a 2 mile notice out. But again, they're going faster than the short lines. If you have a short line going very, very slow to have something 2 miles out, that may not be appropriate for having them remember, oh, yeah, there's something happening. Where is it? Where is it? Where is it? Because they have other things going on when they're operating. So the point is that the reason they've been guidelines so far is that each railroad, based on their operating needs and practices, can adjust it to fit their situation on their system. I just want to point out on that particular stop sign that you're shown on the crossings, that is done under crossing regulations. It is very, very rare to put those up because crossings, as you know, are meant to stop the road traffic to let the train go through. It's always the train movement, and we want people to learn that that's what the train does. The train goes through, you stop as the motorist or the pedestrian. And we use those only when we need the train to stop at a crossing before going over. And I don't know how many of you have ever seen a train be the one to stop at a crossing, but I can tell you it is really, really rare. So us doing a sign, yeah, we can do them, but it's for very special, unique situations. I would be happy to continue the conversation with folks. They have not come to me to tell me that there's a particularly problem with operating practices because, engineers are to do qualifying runs. There are things that they're supposed to do before they go out. If there's a railroad not following operating practices, that is something I regulate under federal rules. I want to know about it. I'll leave you those comments.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Taylor, just help me understand here something I think I heard you say, and I've never operated a train before in my life, not even a toy one. Are you saying then that the whistle signs, or whatever they're called, vary in location by the expected speed of the train and how long it's going to take to get to the crossing? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, what I'm saying is first of all, whistle signs aren't even required. It's an option. But second of all, what is regulated is the distance that they must, based on their speed, which can change literally day to day depending on some circumstances on a railroad, from the crossing. So to just say put them out a quarter of a mile, depending on your speed, that may or may not time well with when you're supposed to sign, when you're supposed to signal. It's a speed.
Fault.
Do you want to say something?
Yeah, if I may.
Yes. Okay. Go ahead. Madam Chair, John would like to contribute something.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Bailey,
can you identify yourself?
Oh, excuse me. My name is John Johnson. I'm the Rail Safety Section Manager for ODOT, okay. Rail Safety Section. What I'd like to say is the federal regulation requires that a train whistle be blown not less than 15 or more than 20 seconds prior to entering a crossing. And depending on the speed of a train, 60 miles an hour, a quarter mile is the correct placement for a whistle board. At 10 miles an hour, that would not be the correct placement. And so the engineer would still be required to make the same judgment as to where he wants to blow that whistle.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm a total layperson, but that doesn't make any sense to me. And I'm glad that we don't do the same thing with our roads. If I'm coming up on an exit on the freeway, it doesn't say 2 minutes to that exit, or the sign isn't different depending on what the posted speed limit is. It's a quarter mile to that exit, no matter how fast you're going. And it would seem to me that based on the technology that I've heard about, where it's pretty easy to calculate based on your speed how long it's going to take you to cross a quarter mile, it would seem to be an appropriate thing to have a sign out a quarter mile. Again, I'm not an expert, I'm just a layperson, but to me this seems like a pretty common sense bill.
Representative Schaffler.
Only to say one thing to the department. You know, and now we do know about it. Now there has been brought to our attention. Now we are aware of it. And I don't think just because it's the first time you've been made aware of something, that's not reason, no matter what the subject is, that's not a reason not to do anything. I mean, if someone brings it to my attention that my house is on fire, I'm not going to sit there and say, well, this is the first I've heard of that, and do nothing. It isn't just this subject. We hear this argument all the time. And now we are aware of it. And once again, I'm going to repeat what the guys who drive the train said. So we'd make a unique system in Oregon, leading to what I would assume some could say is confusing. They're already confused. So I maybe the confusion or the end of the confusion has to start somewhere, and maybe it is here. Because clearly there's a problem. These guys didn't just sit around in their train driving down the darkness making this stuff up. So I don't know if this is the answer or not, but I think clearly there's an issue here, and I would like to see it addressed some way.
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, let me assure you, I'm not saying that just because I just heard of this or didn't know about this that that's not an issue. What I'm saying is frankly, I'm not sure this is the solution, yeah, because the systems operate very differently between short lines and class ones. And frankly, the bulk of the comments you got come from class one operations, and there are 20 short lines and 2 class ones. And I just want to make sure that we don't try to shoehorn something that doesn't fit and won't make sense safe-wise or whatever on a short line system versus a class one. And that's what I don't know, and that's what I think we need to think about.
Hey, on our street signs, Kelly, we don't have giant green and white signs on Ridgecrest Road in my neighborhood. We have little tiny signs. So we can adjust to the size and the speed of these roads relative to what kind of signs they have. So I don't see that as an issue either. Just a matter of adjusting relative to what kind of road it is, what kind of signage is necessary. But I don't see why there's a distinction between how a small railroad runs relative to a larger one. I don't think that prevents us from moving forward and making some kind of uniform sign code. I just don't.
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm talking about placement and stuff,
right,
dictating where to place
them.
That's the part that I am not sure about. I'm not saying that they couldn't all learn a particular sign. I do think the Class 1s have a point that they're in different states. And, again, what may be like in Oregon is different than Idaho and Washington, and the very same engineers that are in Oregon have to go to Washington. I'm just saying I would like to think this through more, and I'm not sure this is the exact approach I would take.
Kelly, I don't see any other hands up right now, but are there other ways that the engineers can, what is my term, figure out where they're at? Are there other types of markers that they're directed to look for as they're operating their trains besides physical signs?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask John. I know that there's qualifying runs that do, and I know there's bulletins that are put out to tell them the changes, but I'll leave to John to answer.
Are there track markers, or are there...
Yeah, Madam Chair, engineers and crew members will be governed by stations, by different locations, by milepost markers, which indicate a location as opposed to a mile on the railroad. A lot of times they will get track warrants, and so they will be able to operate between station number one and station number two, or milepost X and milepost Y, and so they'll operate between those designated points as opposed to an exact mile.
Okay. I think I heard there was something else I was trying to get to, but I can't remember what the entire conversation was. So any other questions? I think that I don't know how many of you have been able to have a chat on this one before, but like I said, I had plenty of chats on this one and lots of information. And I will say it's a little more complicated. I think, to me, I understand, I do understand the difference in the speeds of the trains and where they reach a certain spot. And I do think there is logic there on this one, that one size does not fit all. And I think, I'm not sure I would even compare it on the freeway, because it's, that you're having to, again, you're having to warn somebody that you're coming, and when you're on the freeway, you're not having to warn someone not to pull out in front of you when you're going. And I'm wandering now, but maybe I know too much and not enough on this subject to make a decision, and I don't see any other questions, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2892. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2001. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure, House Bill 2001, is the newest measure we've received, despite having the lowest number. This measure, as written, directs the Department of Transportation to include a specific request for capital construction funding for sharing offices and other facilities with local government in budget requests prepared for the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you, Patrick. Committee, what you're looking at is the beginnings of what we hope will become a transportation package. And what I had hoped was to have a little more in the way of amendments for us to start looking at. But in the meantime, the bill itself has a piece of what will be in the package, talking about sharing locations. And so I think I have someone out there from ODOT that is willing to come up and talk to us about that. And we are in the process of amendments, but it is kind of a work in progress at this point in time. And next time we revisit this, we'll actually have some things to probably talk about.
Excellent. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Transportation. The bill, House Bill 2001, as it exists here, addresses an issue that we've had that's been somewhat of an impediment to co-location. We have co-located to various extents with local governments, the greatest extent in Jackson County, but to some extent in some other places. But one issue we have is when a county or a local government says, gee, we're ready to move, we've got the funding put together, and we're ready to start building a new facility. For one reason or another, but usually it's to move out of town. They come to ODOT and they say, would you like to partner with us and share a facility? This is a good deal for both entities to be co-located together. And because of the way capital construction is budgeted at the state level, we have been in the position where we've said, well, yeah, we're interested, but we've got to go through the entire capital construction process in a regular legislative session in order to get capital construction funding. And the locals, disappointed, have said, well, we can't wait that long, or we don't want to wait that long. What this does, is this bill does, is it basically, we put in a placeholder, probably $1 in the capital construction budget that y'all will approve, and then we'll have the flexibility that should a local government approach us with an idea, concept of co-location, we can then go to the e-board, and we're just more nimble. It's still going to be approved by the legislative body. We're not going to get around that at all. Just makes us a little bit more nimble to be able to sync up when there are opportunities to co-locate with local entities. So this, as it stands alone, is a good bill. I think, with some added sections, it could become a great bill. And so we'll look forward to seeing those added sections in the future.
Me too.
Glad to answer any questions.
Yes, Representative Gottlieb.
Thank you. I'm not a fan of the biennium legislative process, and I'm even lesser a fan of the e-board. How much, especially if we're going to be spending a substantial amount of money on any of these projects, which leads me to the question, how much money are you talking about a given project with local government? I mean, is it in the thousands? Is it in the millions? What are we looking at here?
Chair Beyer, Representative Schaffler, it would be in the millions, probably, depending on what we were doing with the local government, somewhere between $3 and $6 million, I would guess, just on a general co-location of a maintenance facility.
Thank you. I really think that merits discussion of the full body and committee process. I'm not saying I'm going to vote no on the bill, but I don't even like the e-board. You know why I don't like the e-board? Because I ain't on it. Well, there you go.
No other questions on that. Okay. In general, because I know you kind of gave the parameters, how long in planning was the co-location program down in
Jackson County?
Yeah.
It seems so long ago, and it's really probably in this decade. I would guess a total of 12 months, 12 to 18 months maybe. At the outside, we were able to do that because we're leasing the property from Jackson County. They were in a position where they could front the construction money, and so we didn't have to come to the legislature to get a construction budget. That is not usually the case, and so they built it and we're leasing it. That doesn't require a capital construction request to this body. But most of the time, the other counties that have come to us have said, we'd like to go jointly, so you're building and we're building, and they don't have enough money to front the entire cost.
Okay. All right. I don't know that you can answer any other questions that I might have, so, because I don't have the answers for them yet. And thank you for coming.
Sure.
And committee, there have been some agreements that hopefully will be before us on, maybe if we get to them tomorrow night, on where we're at now, and we can have some discussions on those policies. But at least this way we've had our first public hearing, and awesome. We can carry the bill over.
Tomorrow.
And Madam Chair, we're meeting Tuesday and Thursday nights. Is that correct?
For sure, Tuesday night.
When will we know about Thursday?
Madam Chair, we're already posted for Thursday, so
just count on it. Thank you.
Unless we decide not to.
Okay.
meet on Thursday.
Yes. And 12:30 on Wednesday. That's right? Is that right? Oh, Friday. Sorry,
Friday.
Yes. Only on Friday. 12:30 only on Friday. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2001.
What time is it?
Oh, which meeting?
No.
No, we're scheduled for this one.
Okay.
Madam Chair, what time is it on Tuesday, Thursday night? 5:30.
5:30,
both nights.
5:30, yes.
That's why we have some hard lines.
Yeah. Is that posted, Madam Chair? Is that posted now, those times?
Yes.
Those are time.
Yes, they are. Thank you, and we are adjourned.